This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Governor Brown and the activists are basically trying to go in the same, they want the same things, and it seems a shame that people in the climate movement, like progressives do so often, frankly, is let's call out the circular firing squad. Instead of going after the real enemies, you really want to go after the governor who maybe he hasn't done everything you want, but there's no leader on earth who has a better record of climate achievement than Jerry Brown.
Last week in San Francisco, scientists, thought leaders, politicians, and celebrities all gathered for the Global Climate Action Summit. Mark Hertzgard covered the summit for The Nation magazine and is here on Sea Change Radio to provide us with his insights and takeaways from the event. Hertzgard explains the summit's mission, discusses his interview with outgoing California Governor Jerry Brown, and unpacks why it is that some environmental activists decided to protest the summit. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Mark Hertzgard. Mark is the environment correspondent for The Nation magazine, and he's also the author of Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. Mark, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you for having me.
So you recently just covered the Global Climate Action Summit for The Nation. I wanted to first get your 900-foot view of how productive the summit was. Why don't you kind of fill in our listeners with an overview, if possible?
Sure. Well, this summit took place over 2 days, September 13 and 14 in San Francisco, and it brought delegations of government officials and a lot of business types, actually, and of course, activists and scientists together from across the country and around the world. The idea was to both send a message that despite Donald Trump's withdrawal from the Paris Agreement, that much of the United States and the rest of the world is, as they say, we're still in, and we're moving forward, and we're still committed to reaching the Paris Agreement's stated goal of keeping temperature rise on this planet to, quote, well below 2 degrees centigrade. And so that was the idea of it, and I think that in general it was a positive experience. It certainly brought forward a lot of new pledges on the part of state governments, local governments, big corporations, none more impressive and frankly none more ambitious than the pledge made by Governor Jerry Brown of California, saying that he had signed an executive order committing the entire state of California to be carbon neutral by the year 2045. That is really unprecedented. We now have the fifth biggest economy in the world, California, saying that it is going to be carbon neutral, zero net carbon emissions by 2045, which is what the science says is necessary. But boy, that is a steep climb. In fact, Governor Brown said at the press conference, the metaphor I like to use is that we've made it to the base camp of Mount Everest, which is, I think, 17,000 feet, and then we're looking up at how much farther we still have to go, but we're going to go.
And the base camp of Everest is quite polluted these days, so that metaphor is apt in many levels. So,
good point.
So the summit itself, who was responsible for putting it on, and how does it, if at all, how does it work with the United Nations climate change conferences like the COP21, the Copenhagen, the Paris conferences? Is there real policy being discussed here, or are they more platitudes?
No, there's real policy. I should say that I interviewed Governor Brown for the long article I did in The Nation magazine about this for the summit, and I asked him this very question, and here's the way it breaks down. The Global Climate Action Summit in California was not an official United Nations summit. However, it was certainly part of that process, intended and designed as part of that process. The origin of the summit actually dates back to before Donald Trump was president, even before he was running, really. It was at the Paris summit in 2015, in December 2015, the same summit that gave us the Paris Agreement. Brown told me that shortly after the signing of that agreement, he was asked by Cristiana Figueres, who was the United Nations official who chaired the Paris summit. She came to him privately and said, would you host an interim summit in 2018 to keep the momentum moving after Paris? Because essentially this California summit is sort of the halfway point between the 2015 summit in Paris and a second summit that is scheduled also in Paris in 2019 or 2020, where the governments who all agreed in Paris 2015 that we're going to limit temperature rise to 2 degrees Celsius, now they've got to come forward with the very specific concrete action plans, that's the UN term, action plans, for how they're going to achieve those pledges. What are you actually going to do? Taking an example, Indonesia, to reduce your deforestation to levels that will honor the 2 degree agreement. What are you going to do, China, to continue to shut coal mines and coal-fired power plants to meet your obligations? And so the idea of the summit here in California was essentially to share best practices among different state governments, local governments, and businesses, and thereby increase both the ambition and the achievement all over the world. And so that's why Figueres picked California, asked Governor Brown to do this, because California, even then in 2015, had a record of climate achievement that was second to none among the major economies in the world. And again, as I say, California at that point was the sixth biggest economy. Now it's the fifth biggest economy in the world. And it had already was well on its way to reducing its emissions back to 1990 levels. And in fact, it did that 4 years ahead of schedule. It was supposed to do it by 2020. It had already done it by 2016. And Jerry Brown had also just signed an important bill, SB 350, that committed California to be going much farther, and in particular to double the energy efficiency of its buildings and to shift much of its transportation sector away from gasoline onto electricity. And so that was why Cristiana Figueres asked Jerry Brown, will you please host a summit in California to rally the world and keep the world moving? Of course, at that point, nobody had any idea that Donald Trump would be the next president of the United States and say that he's going to withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Agreement. And that, of course, added extra drama and, frankly, some doubt, I think, about the summit here in California. And the question being, could Jerry Brown and other leaders rally the rest of the world enough to keep moving and overcome the resistance that's now emanating from Donald Trump's Washington?
What was your reaction to Jerry Brown getting scrutinized by the left in this scenario, Mark?
Yeah, there were hundreds of activist groups over the summer leading up to this summit who were protesting the Brown administration, saying, yes, he's done great things, but he hasn't done enough. And in particular, they said he has not stopped fracking in the state of California. And the activists also wanted him to halt all new oil and gas production. Not all production, but all new production. They said, look, during the 8 years that Jerry Brown's been governor, he's permitted 20,000 new oil wells in the state of California. And science, the activists continue, science says that we've got to leave most of the fossil fuels in the ground now if we're going to honor the 2 degree Celsius limit. And the activists further charged that Brown was not acting in these directions because he was basically in the pay of the oil industry. They pointed out that the oil industry has contributed roughly $9 million to him and the Democratic Party and other causes of his during his years as governor. I had the chance to ask Governor Brown about that during our interview in Sacramento, and he just about jumped off his office couch when I raised that point. He was so annoyed, I think, by the activist allegations, which he considers just naive demagoguery. And he says, look, I challenge anyone to find a state that's done more than I have and than we have here in California. And this idea of shutting down oil production, you know, Californians drive 343 million miles a year, collectively, obviously, in the state. If we shut down the oil, he says, what would happen? Would there be shootings, killings, chaos? He says, you'd never get close to achieving that before the public reaction shut it down. Now, as I point out in my piece in The Nation, that's a caricature. Governor Brown is a pretty gross caricature of what the activists are actually asking. They aren't asking for an immediate halt to all gasoline sales in the state of California. What they are urging is a gradual planned phased decline in oil production in California. And the tragedy, I think, is that at this stage in the climate crisis, it's possible that both Governor Brown and the activists are right. The activists are certainly right that science says that we've got to stop new oil and gas production. But on the other hand, Jerry Brown and other administrators of the status quo bring forward political and economic truths that are just as valid, which is that this society is deeply, deeply addicted and dependent upon fossil fuels. It's an addiction that has grown over 100 years, and it's not something that you can easily or precipitously break without causing real reaction, both among the general public, who still, most of whom still rely on gasoline for their transportation, and frankly, among the oil industry, which is powerful. You know, you may like them or not like them, but there's no question they're the richest industry in history, very, very powerful. And for example, I report in my Nation magazine piece that when Governor Brown and Kevin DeLeon, then the state president of the state Senate, when they were trying to pass in 2015, right before the Paris summit, they passed the bill SB 350, which, as I mentioned earlier, doubles building energy efficiency in the state, makes the transportation sector electric, and to the point where we're going to have electric charging stations for vehicles almost as ubiquitously as we see gasoline stations now. There was a third piece in that bill, and that was exactly what the activists were asking for, a 50% reduction in California's oil production over the years. Well, at the end of the day, that provision was removed from the bill by Brown and DeLeon. And Brown and DeLeon went to before the press. They had a press conference afterwards, and Brown said, look, we just didn't have the votes to pass the whole bill unless we took that provision out. I'm going to keep fighting for it, but the oil industry is powerful. And he had a concluding line that I think gets to the point here. He said, look, the oil industry is going to lose trillions of dollars over the next 20 years because of this legislation. We're taking away half their market. I don't expect them to play patty cake about that. So that's the crux of it, I think. You know, it's the conflict between real-world politics and power that Brown is talking about on one hand, and on the other hand, the scientific truth that we absolutely have got to leave this stuff in the ground if we're going to reach the 2 degrees limit. And so that, to me, is the tragedy. It's because we waited so long, because the world has really not taken serious action for 30 years against climate change, and that largely because of resistance from Washington under Democrats and Republicans alike. So now we're at a stage here in 2018 where we have got to shut down the emissions so thoroughly and so rapidly that I think there's a real question. Can our modern societies, our governing structures, our economic structures, can they react that fast? And we'll see. But I think that there's truth on both sides, and it's unfortunate because you know, Governor Brown and the activists are basically trying to go in the same, they want the same things. And it seems a shame that people in the climate movement, like progressives do so often, frankly, is let's call out the circular firing squad. Instead of going after the real enemies, you really want to go after the governor who maybe he hasn't done everything you want, but there's no leader on earth who has a better record of climate achievement than Jerry Brown.
Make you see stars, make you lose your mind. Is there nothing I can do that'll somehow show what happens when a conscience hits an overload? So let's go. We'll return, but we own. Can only pretend that it's so. Can't wipe away what we know.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to Mark Hertzgard. He's the environment correspondent for The Nation magazine. We're talking about Jerry Brown and the activists who were opposing some of the policies that were being discussed at the Global Climate Action Summit in San Francisco last week. The indigenous activists, for example, locked themselves down outside of the summit and were saying that market-based systems like cap and trade are quote-unquote false solutions. After sitting down with Jerry Brown and hearing that he's perturbed by them and he could benefit from meeting with some of the leaders from these activist movements, has he? And if he hasn't, how do you think those might go? Do you think it might help allay the fears of these activists that California is not moving in the right direction?
Well, I think that where the activists do have a stronger claim is on the question of environmental justice. Jerry Brown can say, look, California still relies on oil. We need to get the oil from someplace. We'd rather get it from here in California than from across the world. Okay, that's on the macro level. But on the micro level, there are oil wells and fracking going on at oil wells within very short distances of schools and homes all throughout Kern County and the big oil-producing regions in the southern part of California. I've reported on that. I've seen that. I've talked to the young people and the families who are experiencing asthma and other illnesses, possibly because of their exposure to those fracking sites. And so that environmental justice argument, I think, is a powerful one that I have not heard Governor Brown speak to. And there is, for example, Annie Leonard, the head of Greenpeace USA, said in an interview at the summit, Governor Brown doesn't care about environmental justice. That's their accusation. And I think that there's that Governor Brown needs to have a better answer on that. And I don't think that it would be that hard to put forward a policy that restricts fracking in particular and oil wells that are within 2,500 feet of a school, for example. Now, again, in fairness to the governor, he pushes back and says, look, I don't have dictatorial powers here, and it's not my preference for this, but if I put forward an executive order on this stuff that shut down these wells or say we can't do more, that will immediately lead to lawsuits. The policy won't happen. And what I want is legislation that passes to do this, because that way you're free from the lawsuits. So would it change? Would Governor Brown's mind change if he met with these activists? Jerry Brown is a very self-confident person in his views. He likes to debate. We debated a lot in our interview. He likes to go back and forth with people, Socratic method and all that. I don't get the sense, however, that he's necessarily open to new ideas. And unfortunately, he's certainly not going to be doing it now that this movement has insulted him and shamed him, and he feels, in a demagogic way, have been very opportunistic to attack him at this summit. So I think that that opportunity is past. He certainly meets with environmentalists, don't get me wrong. The California Environment, Environment California Group and others in Sacramento, they talk with Brown and his staff all the time. Has he met with indigenous people, with the people in Brazil or the people in Kern County who are suffering from these illnesses? That I rather doubt. But, you know, at this point, it's kind of moot because he's leaving the governorship. There'll be an election in November, of course, and we'll have a new governor in January. And if it's Gavin Newsom, the current lieutenant governor, I expect that most of Brown's policies will simply be continued under the new administration.
So, Mark, you were at the summit. There's a lot of headlines made by Jerry Brown, the activists that we've discussed, but also Michael Bloomberg was there and Harrison Ford made a rousing speech. But maybe you can go beyond the headlines and give us a feel for what it was like being there and maybe some anecdotes of people that you talked to who were maybe a little skeptical about it, and then maybe others who gave you hope that this was part of a bigger, important movement.
Sure. Well, this took place at the Moscone Convention Center in downtown San Francisco. And I would say I didn't run into many skeptics, certainly no climate science deniers, but even people who were skeptical about what this could lead to. I don't think you would come to this summit if you felt that way. You know, I covered the Paris summit, I covered the Copenhagen summit, I covered the Earth summit back in Rio de Janeiro in 1992. And these things all have a similar kind of ambience where there's activists and officials and scientists and policymakers all, you know, rubbing up against each other. I have to say, in terms of anecdotes, it does concern Governor Brown, but it was certainly the most quotable line that came out of the whole conference. We were at the press conference the morning of the summit opening, and a reporter from overseas asked Brown, how will Donald Trump be remembered for his climate policies? And Brown, in his answer, noted that the Trump administration had just put forward a new rule that basically says we're going to allow more methane to be emitted from natural gas production, not less. We don't want limits on methane. And Brown said, you know, that's either insane or criminal. So I guess if you ask me how Trump will be remembered, what would I say? A liar? A criminal? A fool? Take your pick. So you could just see all of the reporters in the room, they're scratching out that line, and that was going to be the lead of everybody's story. It was certainly in my lead at The Nation magazine. And then Michael Bloomberg also said something very interesting there, which is that he's going to spend $80 million between now and the November midterm elections trying to help flip the House of Representatives to the Democrats. And he says, look, I've been a Democrat in my life, I've been a Republican, I've been an independent, but I'm going to help the Democrats flip the House now because the Republicans have had their chance to govern and they have failed. And they have failed in particular on this climate issue and on gun control, another concern for Bloomberg. And so I'm going to spend $80 million. So that was pretty big news. And then another individual I was very impressed by is Johan Rockström. He is the he's the scientist at the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impacts in Germany, which is probably the world's premier climate science institute. And I had a chance to sit down with him for half an hour and talk with him about, this exponential theme. Can we really get there now that we've waited so long to really make progress? And he had just published two big studies this summer. Many of the listeners will have heard about the so-called hothouse Earth study, that if we continue to on our current path for emissions, we could easily drive this planet into runaway global warming that would be unsurvivable. But the second study that they did had not gotten as much attention, and maybe that's because it's got a positive message, and we in the media don't respond very well to positive messages, but I thought it was very interesting. Basically, he said, look, the exponential improvements now in solar and wind and other renewable technologies are such that we still, from a natural science basis, we still have, the window is still open to honoring the Paris Agreement and keeping the temperature rise well under 2 degrees Celsius. He says it's barely open, but that window is still open. And so when people say, oh, I'm pessimistic, I'm in despair about climate change, he says, that may be your psychological choice, but you cannot blame that on the science. The natural science tells us we still have this opportunity. Now, if you tell me, he went on to say, if somebody says, oh, well, the Chinese will never shut down their coal power plants, and Donald Trump will never get, on the right side of this issue, et cetera, Rockstrom says, well, those are political decisions, and political decisions can be changed. But the science, don't blame the science. This is a human choice at this point. And also, Rockstrom added, it turns out we don't need 100% of the people. We don't even need 51% of the people. Look at what's already happening with solar and wind and the exponential decreases in price. That's with only about 10 to 15% of the people and the companies involved getting on the solar and wind bandwagon. So the tipping points, he said, can go in the positive direction as well. And what he urges, and I would urge too, is for everyone to try and be on the positive side of those tipping points with solar, wind, and politics, pushing politicians like Governor Brown or the next governor, perhaps Newsom, pushing them, but also creating the political space where those political leaders can do what's necessary despite the pushback from Big Oil and the other members of what at The Nation magazine we call the climate wrecking industry. They will always be pushing back, but if there is enough pressure on politicians to do the right thing, I think you can get there. And so, of course, the November midterm elections will be very important in that regard. If we do see a lot of Republicans voted out, I think that will send a real message to that party that if you continue to follow Donald Trump and his climate denial and everything else that Trump has done, you do so at your own peril.
I really like Johan Rockström's work, and we had him on Sea Change Radio a couple of years ago, and I suggest our listeners go to the Sea Change Radio archives and check out a half-hour interview that I had with him February 2nd, 2016, where we talk about his book, Big World, Small Planet, and talk about the approach that Sweden has taken to reduce carbon emissions. I also really appreciate your work. You're one of our finest environmental reporters. Mark Hertzgaard, the environment correspondent for The Nation. Mark, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
I appreciate it, Alex. Take care.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by the Above Average Black Band and Fog Swamp.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.